Welcome to our next episode of the Work Healthy Podcast. I'm John Ryan, and thanks for joining me. For our next three podcasts, we're focusing on India. As of 2022, it has the largest population in the world. And coupled with that fact, it's now the third largest growing economy. So I think it's timely that we learn more about business and workplaces in India. Today, we start this spotlight series by talking to a person who's been named one of the 100 most influential global HR professionals by the World HRD Congress. That's Sujoy Banerjee. Sujoy is Group Chief People Officer and Group Head Marketing, Corporate Communications and PR at Gainwell Group. Gainwell employs over 3,500 people with offices in West Virginia in the US, offices in Newcastle in New South Wales, Australia, and their headquarters in Kolkata, formerly Calcutta in India. As the main partner for Caterpillar in India, they operate mainly in the construction, mining, energy and transportation space. Today, we'll discuss India and its demographic dividend, the changes that have occurred post-pandemic, the Gainwell company itself and its company culture, and why their values are seen as the glue that keeps the organization and its people connected, and what the alpha generation are demanding, and why Sujoy gives a direct access hotline to his desk to those, and why they use Chatbox to keep connected with that cohort. I started the interview by asking him just how different are workplaces in India.
India as a country, as you know, is a very old country. The civilization is very, very old. 5,000 years old civilization. And this country has gone through a lot of cross-cultural integration over the years. India is a country which is known to be a pot boiler of culture and beliefs. So you've got people from all across the world who's over a period of this last 5,000 years of civilization has come and settled into India with their, and therefore there are a lot of faiths, beliefs, and cultures which coexist in this country. And by today's population, we are the world's largest, well, the most populous country.
Yeah, I noticed.
No, I don't know whether that's a credit or not, but then that's 140 million people. It's big. So we've overrun China. So I don't know whether it's a matter of credit, but then in terms of the young population or the working population, the world is aging, be it Europe, be it China, or be it many other parts of the world. India is at an inflection point where it's poised for growth. It's the third largest growing economy in the world. There's something which we are trying to leverage in this country is a demographic dividend, because the working population in India, which is typically from, say, early 20s to 35, which that population is largest in India now, because they are poised to enter the world of working or the corporate world. So that's what our prime minister or the country always says, the economist says, that we are trying to reap the demographic dividend, which is basically trying to leverage the younger generation of this country, which is getting into the working population. Whereas in the rest of the world, you're having an aging population. Mm. So India is having a population which is getting into the work life. And therefore, India as a population is also ready to hit the road across the world. Because Indian young population, the young generation, is ready to take up assignments globally. So it's not only India which is going to benefit out of it, be it Europe, be it in the US, North America, South America, where the population is globally aging, Indian youth or the Indian young generation is a target population they should look at to attract as professionals in various parts of the world. So India as a country is, as I said, poised for phenomenal growth. Yes. In spite of the COVID, we have not hit the bottom of the curve in terms of economic growth. So India is a country which has emphasized or invested over the last decade or so, or last 20 years or two decades or so, on digitalization of the Indian economy. India is one country which has the largest number of digital payment platforms. the number of the usage of internet in terms of data consumption is one of the highest in this country. The usage of internet banking or digital payment platform, India has highest digital payment users. So India as a country has invested a lot on technology and IT infrastructure, because we believe that that's going to facilitate growth, that's going to drive growth for the economy at large. So India is on that point of inflection where we are seeing a lot of rationalization happening in the banking sector, a lot of focus happening on the IT sector, a lot of emphasis is happening on space and technology. So on various pockets of this country, the government at the center, which runs the country, and there are 29 states in this country, which have their own federal states. We are a federal structure. So, and therefore these states also work with the government at the center to drive growth and growth in the economy. So.
It's amazing, actually. I mean, like the population piece, that lots of people don't realize just quite how big India is. And from a population point of view, other countries in the world, I'm soon to go to South Korea, and their fertility level is dropping. They're one of the lowest in the world. Whereas, obviously, the young population in India is just a really hope for the future in terms of the country. And I suppose what you say there, it's a melting pot of many different cultures. So diversity is not going to be a problem in workplaces across the board. So that's really interesting. And where India is going, I mean, I think you sent a rocket to the moon recently. So it's really interesting. Oh, one thing that somebody said to me was that oftentimes people in different parts of India don't actually speak the language, and they actually find it easier to speak English as a common language there. So that was one thing that kind of surprised me about the size of it. Just in kind of doing a little bit of research for the interview with yourself, I was actually drawn to a particular video you did during COVID. And I was interested because, it's amazing when you revisit those videos, what people were saying and talking about and how they were trying to navigate that horrible moment in work and workplaces and society in general. I'm just wondering, if you look back now at how you navigated it and the effect it's had, what is post-pandemic India like now? What impact has it had?
Post-pandemic India is different. 20 months of a lockdown, of people working out of home, people not being able to get back to their workplaces has impacted a lot of people, both in terms of how they look at work, how they look at life, John, because life became uncertain. We did not know whether what's in store for us tomorrow. All of us globally, we were fighting for our lives. We didn't have a vaccine. We didn't have a cure. People were trying all sorts of methods, all sorts of medications, combinations, cocktails to stay alive. So people have actually recalibrated the way they look at life. So is making money the only driver for me to work? Or am I looking at life in a much more holistic way and looking at my family, or looking at the people around me, the ecosystem which I have been surviving all these years? They are now playing a very important role in decision-making of individuals in this country. Because we suddenly realize, our corporate lives or our professional lives are important, but then there are other elements to our life which makes life more holistic. So are we looking at those dimensions of life with equal importance as much as we do to our professional lives? So I think that's a huge change which has impacted the society at large. And I can see that even within the professional domain or the ecosystem, there are a lot of people who are revisiting the way they led their professional lives. So they're looking at, is money or compensation the only satisfier, or the quality of life that I lead is an important element of my decision making? So there has been a massive change in the way people have started looking at life in a macro perspective in this country.
And so did the Great Resignation hit India the same way as hit other places in the world?
No, not to that extent. Yes, it has hit the IT industry to a certain extent, because, John, you would appreciate that IT being a operation or a function which is location agnostic, which is not dependent where I sit in code or where I do and develop a software. So people, when they went back to their base towns where their families lived, away from their workplaces, they suddenly realized that, okay, I can do 4 hours of work with my company and do another 4 hours of work with other companies. So moonlighting started happening. So, and companies, the IT companies especially, had a huge challenge in managing this moonlighting. Because so people were taking double employments, triple employments. So they're working for one company during 4 hours in the morning and then working for another one. So that was a challenge which a lot of IT and technology companies face, be it software services or product companies, because there the people went back to their base towns and they were allowed to operate out of their homes. So they got habituated to this. And then the lure of getting some additional dough worked with them and they started. So moonlighting was a challenge. It was, I would call it the Great Resignation, which had hit the Western world. To that extent, it was there. But yes, it's not that it had hit us, certain sectors of the economy in certain ways. Because in India, still, it's a economy which is still evolving. It is not an advanced economy. So there are a lot of jobs which are still pretty, I would say, labor intensive, or which involves your being in person to present. So they wanted to get back to work, because many companies could not afford to pay salaries when the operations were closed. So they separated employees to take care of the cost. Others did not pay their salaries on time. So people wanted to get back to work. Though government did provide support systems to these people who are in the unorganized sector and bottom of the pyramid through support programs, through government-funded monthly incomes, but minimum income. But they wanted to go back to their old income levels. So they were very eager to get back to work. So some industries in this country got affected by the resignation problem, or the Great Resignation that people have been talking about globally. But people wanted to get back to work. It's not that many parts of the world, people were reluctant to get back to work. They were saying that you take my way or the highway sort of a thing. But I don't think that happened in India. Yes, in certain sectors, people were initially thinking that way. But then people have realized that, yes, it's better that I go back to my normal work life.
And so how has it played out there? Because I'm noticing now, while organizations had no choice but to let people work from at home, some of them were doing that reluctantly. Some of them were surprised that productivity wasn't affected too bad. In some cases, it increased, while people were trying to convince employers that this actually would work as a concept. But it's interesting now, because I'm noticing and talking to more and more CEOs, and they're sort of saying, I've had enough. I want them back. And this is causing a tension, because obviously there's a set of employees who don't see a benefit and believe that, you know, listen, I can do this job just as well from my home or from a remote location without the hassle and the transport and costs and the like. How is that playing out in India?
In companies, again, depends on the nature of the organization, as I say, because if you talk about the IT and the technology sector, there the employees, either they work or the consulting sector also, they used to work a lot from their client sites, because depending on nature. So they were anyway not coming to their offices or working out of their headquarters or wherever they were. So now, instead of the client side, they're working out of home. So therefore, they are asking the same question. Why do I need to get back to the workspace? I'm giving you my deliveries on time, as per quality. So that tussle is on in that sector. But then, as you rightly said, the CEOs are saying, guys, get back to work, get back to office. Because at the end of the day, what's been seen, John, socially, is that it's taking a toll on the mental health. Mm. Because you are cooped up in a room, sitting in front of your laptop, not talking to any of your colleagues. And some of the social interactions helps you to also evolve as a human being. When you go to work, you have a break, coffee break, you sit with your friend or your colleague, have a cup of coffee, have a cigarette, have whatever. Just relax. And maybe you talk shop, but then you come to a lot of, through your interpersonal relationships, you come to a lot of problem resolutions also.
Yeah.
So, and the bonding within the employees, that stickiness with the organization increases, because that stickiness creates the organizational culture. People at times look forward to it rather than just sitting in front of a laptop and working, because that is taking a toll on the mental health, which is not only affecting the organization, affecting the family at large, leading to a lot of mental issues and erratic behavior in the minds of the people. Therefore, it's very, very important that we play a lot of emphasis on getting back employees to the workspace. And that tussle is on, but only in a very specified sector, because things like banking, things like manufacturing, things like FMCG, the customer interaction is very important. The customer needs to see you, hear you, not on a virtual mode. In an IT or a consulting space, that's still working, but that is getting shrunk day by day.
Yeah. Okay. So you mentioned culture and the like. So let's turn to Gainwell, your organization. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about it, introduce it, but specifically if you could talk about the culture that you've created.
Gainwell is a partner of Caterpillar in this country, Caterpillar of the US. We sell and do aftermarket of Caterpillar equipment in the construction space, in the energy and transportation space, which is basically packaged energy solutions, and in the mining space, that is underground mining as well as surface mining. We sell Caterpillar equipment and we service them. We sell it to the customers and help them to run their operations. That's one part of our business. The second part of our business is manufacturing of underground mining equipment, which Caterpillar globally has stopped manufacturing. So they've given us intellectual property and we manufacture them in India under a scheme where Indian government is giving us a lot of incentives, the tax incentives. So we manufacture them in India and sell them globally. So we have an office in West Virginia in the US where I've got 50 of my colleagues sitting out there, US citizens, and about 20 of them sitting in New South Wales in Australia in a place called Newcastle, not the one which is in England, but Newcastle. One of the biggest coal handling ports in the world. So that's one which sells, which manufactures underground mining equipment and sells them globally and does the aftermarket or the maintenance of those equipment. And the third is another company which is also in the manufacturing of equipment like cranes, material handling equipment, and also does a lot of work for the Indian defense in terms of their missile launching systems and at very high altitudes. And so that's another. So we are in the manufacturing of capital goods and also in the space of selling and servicing of Caterpillar equipment. So this is by and large the Gainwell Group. We have about 3,500 employees across the group. Over a period of time, the way we have built this 8-year-old company, but this new management has taken over the leadership of this company about 8 years back. So we have an 8-year-old legacy with an eight-year-old child, which is managing the legacy now. So over the last 8 years, we've tried to give this organization its unique culture, a unique character of its own. And the biggest contributor to this culture creation has been our values. Our values has been the drivers for creating this culture. Our values are collaboration, customer centricity, caring, the 3C, plus 2E. 2Es are entrepreneurship and excellence. So these are the 5 values on which the organization rests. So anything that we do in this organization to create the culture is built around these values. We don't do anything which is contradiction, which in contradiction to these values. So institutionalization of these values, communicating them constantly, every day, every minute to every member of this organization, whenever he or she joins, has given us that character of this organization. We've made these values a part of our DNA, which determines our entire nature, our character, the way we handle our business, our stakeholders, our employees.
Because I've obviously been in roles like this for about 30 years, and I've seen so many organizations who proclaim to have values, but they don't live them at all. They're just on a wall for PR purposes. Whereas when I come to your website, the very first thing I see on your website is your values. So, I mean, it's clear to me that they are I think you mentioned in a previous interview, the glue that holds the organization together. So how do you bring them alive for people? Do you tell stories or what approach do you use to make sure they land?
Interesting. When we started cascading this communication of values, because these values was a bottom-up approach of creation of these values. It's not that the leadership team woke up one fine morning, got down into the boardroom, said that, no, these are the five values we're going to live by, and everybody has lived with it. No. We started talking to people. We started talking to people. We did a lot of large-scale interactive process where we connected with people and co-created the values of this organization, co-created what are we going to live by, the philosophy of our organization. So that was very, very important for us to live these values and to create these values. So once we gave these values or define these values, then the question came, how do we communicate these values? These values need to resonate with the people. They need to understand. So what we did was we got starting stories from the field, from the ground level, that what do these values mean to you? Have you lived these values? Then we started getting stories of people who have actually lived these values and demonstrated these values at the grassroots level. We captured those stories and communicated down the line that this is what your colleagues have done. This is how a customer service was handled. This is how a customer problem was handled. This is what excellence means. This is how you have pushed the envelope, walked an extra mile to live up to the organizational commitments. This is what caring is all about, how we've cared for our customers, how we care for our colleagues. So these were stories from the lives of our employees. We didn't create those stories. We didn't say Mr. X or Mr. Y, or didn't give ideal life stories which a writer can write. We said that these what your people, your colleagues have lived, and this they have demonstrated these values. So these values became more close to heart. They started owning these values. Every quarter, we have 1 month, which is called a value month, where we collate stories from various parts of the organization. And we say that, okay, guys, give us instances where your colleagues or your team members have demonstrated these values. When they share with us, we validate them and we broadcast them across the organization. We recognize these people through certificates, through small gifts that, guys, thanks for being the champion of our values. We have good call them the value champions, and we recognize them as people who are actually demonstrating the values and championing the cause of making the values a part of our life. So it's a constant communication process, John. We have not stopped it. Yeah. It has to go on and on and on because people change. People come and leave the organization. It cannot be a one-off exercise. People have to believe in the values, live with these values as long as they are Gainwell citizens.
And out of interest, do you incorporate those values into your reward and recognition systems and into your performance management system?
Yes, values is also, as we are now talking, we are in the midst of a project which is redefining the entire competency framework. So demonstrations of our values will also be a competency, a behavioral competency. So we are going to talk about values as part of our behavioral competency, which goes into the career management and performance management of our employees. So, yes, values is something which rewards a part of a rewards and recognition process also.
Okay. And so look, drilling into obviously the one that's most closely aligned to what Healthy Place to Work is all about is that caring piece and the commitment you have to your employees. I'm just kind of interested. Obviously, the Healthy Place to Work model is about, you know, purpose and meaning, mental resilience, connections, social connection and social health, and the physical health aspect of that. So give me a sense of the employee experience in Gainwell. I love the name of the company because it's like, you know, well is what you want people to be. And if they are, the whole place gains. I'm sure that's not why you have the name Gainwell, but it's a nice story. I'd just love to know, how do you go about making sure that it is a really healthy place to work?
I'm not getting into the physical health part of it because that most of the companies do. That's a given thing, to have insurance schemes to take care of your health, hospitalization, health checkup camps, be it eye, be it dental, be it everything. So those are the, I think it's the basics that any company should provide.
It's funny you say that, but lots of companies don't. So You don't actually take anything for granted in this world. In that regard, I mean, I think I noticed you also extend those benefits to family members too.
Yes. Even to parents.
Okay, that's really good.
Because healthcare in India, it's not as evolved as the NHS in the UK. Education and healthcare are two areas where government has still not lived up to its commitments over the last, since 1947. Sure. So the private sector or the other companies have been in the public sector, the private sector has to come forward and support the employees. So it's not that what you get in the US or in the United Kingdom, though there are a lot of challenges in NHS that I read in the television, see in television or read in newspapers, but as a framework, I'm talking as a concept and a framework.
Sure.
So private sector companies and public sector companies in India have this practice and policy of giving healthcare support to these employees through insurance support by paying the premium and tying up with a hospital or a group of hospitals where you can get your family checked up, whatever it is. So therefore, that's one thing in Indian context, I would say, is more or less given a physical health support system. It varies. It varies depending on the affordability of the organization or even the intent, as you rightly said. Some people do, some people don't, but by and large, I'm talking majority. Because that's a cost outflow of the organization. So it depends on the affordability and a lot of other things, but basics they support. What is more important is the mental health of the employee, which is taking a greater emphasis post-COVID. It was happening in the since about 2018, 2017, but it suddenly took a very exponential growth of in terms of the need post-COVID. So what we have done is we've realized that it's just not physical health, it's the mental health. That employee comes into the workplace, if he or she suffers from stress, strain because of issues which is not physical but has an impact on his mental health, then the productivity certainly gets impacted. If you ask me that whether I have a direct correlation of investments in mental health to productivity, no, it's very difficult correlation to establish. But yes, we as an organization, we have had a lot of mental health support system schemes in the organization, which is currently running. We have empaneled psychologists who are available on call to all our employees we have designated time, but then we don't want to know who's calling at what time for what purpose, because that's very personal and private and confidential, because people may be not talking about themselves, maybe talking about the children, their spouse, what are the challenges they have. We want to give them a pair of ears who listen to them, who has that expertise to provide them with options of solutions, because you can't solve it for people. We believe in one thing, you have a bouncing board who hears you, helps you to come to solutions, because mental health, you cannot always give solutions, because the context you don't know many a times. So therefore, we are providing platforms where we have mentoring systems, we have these psychological helpline systems, and we also have counseling for parents, because bringing up children in today's environment is becoming a challenge, as we were talking the other day also. Because the younger generation, the so-called alpha generation, what they're talking about, because names of the generation changes every 2 years. I was used to Gen Z. Now I suddenly hear there's something called alpha generation. So their requirements from life, from their parents, from the people around them, is something like you walk into a quick service restaurant and want an immediate service of food. It's instant gratification, be it on Instagram or a Facebook or social media or a Twitter. X, to be precise. So there are a lot of people, multi-generation people, are finding it difficult to manage things at home. Multi-generation people are finding to manage their employees, younger generation employees who are just coming out of colleges and joining their teams. So I'm also enabling them to cope with change and manage these generations and have a better work life in their workspace. So we are making these constant efforts.
I was just wondering, how do you, keep in contact and keep connected with the younger profile of employees who are joining the organization?
I personally do is, I have something called a hotline to the GCC as Group Chief People Officer. As a Group Chief People Officer, every Friday between 12 noon to 2 p.m., I sit at my desk and await calls from anywhere across the country, and especially younger generation. I have an AI-based chatbot system only targeted towards my young generation, people in the age group of 21 to 30, people who have just joined this organization 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, and talk to them. I get the feedback and I dial them in and talk to them. I go across to the locations and talk to them, have small focus group meetings with these people, trying to figure out what is it that they feel this organization should do to make their life happier in this organization? And what do they expect from the organization in terms of professional value add to them?
Yeah. And could I just dig into that? So an AI chatbot specifically focused on that cohort. Yeah. How does that work?
I work with a partner organization. And we give them the list of employees every month. So they send out a survey questionnaire as if I'm sending it out. It goes under my name. Yeah. So it comes, I take a download next morning, and I see what are these guys talking about, where they're talking about. And within 24 hours, I call them back and say that, hey, guys, thank you for sharing your feedback. Even if it's three positives and one negative, I said, thank you for the three positives you mentioned. But I'm worried about the one negative that you mentioned.
Sure.
And we try to get them addressed through my team or through their line managers. And I tell them that, okay, fine. This may not be addressable immediately. It might take a month's time, 6 months' time, because it might bring about a change in policy, the way we look at our processes. But then I have this constant communication with them, because what I've realized is if you don't communicate with your employees, especially this group of employees, the relationship snaps, because then they realize that there's no one to hear us. So why should I even voice my opinion? Then
they suddenly get into from those conversations, what are you kind of surprised at in terms of, like, are the expectations completely different to, older employees in the organization?
Yes, to a large extent, because what I find this new generation is they are socially conscious. They're talking about stuff like ESG. They're talking about sustainable growth. They're talking about the organization's commitment to the society. What are we doing for the society? They want to be part of those initiatives. They want to understand what is our commitment to contribute to reducing the carbon footprint. Even in the areas that we work in, underground mining or mining for that matter, which is absolutely against environmental sustainability.
Yeah.
So they question that, what are you guys doing? Are you into afforestation? Are you doing anything to reduce the damage you're causing to the earth because of mining? Because whether we like it or not, John, for the next 30 years, fossil fuel is still a reality. Till the world across, we have a better solution of green energy, which is affordable. You have this COP28, everything is happening. But then how much of this alternative energy solutions are affordable by the developing or the underdeveloped nations? So there has to be a sustainable green energy solution where the world over we can afford. So coal will still be a reality for next maybe 2 decades or 3 decades. So in that context, being a company which is into mining, which is supporting mining, these youngsters are asking the basic questions.
So they're pushing the agenda and they want to hear your sustainability story. Yes.
Yeah,
it's good to hear. It's fascinating.
And they're talking really about inclusivity. They're talking about inclusivity.
Yeah.
It's just not gender inclusivity. They're talking about LGBTQ plus.
Yeah.
Guys, what are you doing? Are you awake to the fact that people have different sexual preferences? People have different needs. You can't make them be marginalized part of the society. What is your commitment to bring them into the mainstream? They're asking those questions.
Yeah, and just around the mental health, because, you know, it's a huge explosion at the moment. I mean, the data that we're bringing back to organizations is just that, like, the anxiety levels, the stress levels are really high. The social isolation is an issue. And also, by the way, people aren't being physically fit, which there's a huge connection between physical fitness and mental health. So apart from sort of just, you know, getting psychologists online to support people, are there any other things you're doing as an organization to try and change how you're put together, how managers support people?
What, as you rightly said, mental health and physical health actually go together. We are pushing our managers, and we haven't put into their scorecard as part of their any score about the physical health and mental health, but then we encourage people to go on run marathons. We are promoting any sport which helps you to come out of the couch and start exerting yourself.
Yeah.
So we are encouraging. We are sponsoring our employees. We are taking part and saying that a lot of in India, marathon has taken up a big, and corporates are sponsoring marathons and but so. Be it marathons, be it things like a session on where you have to do a walkathon. We have these competitions where employees across the country are divided into teams based on their locations and the number of steps they walk. And the total team effort, they win prizes. They're given those smartwatches, the health watches. So through these employee engagement initiatives, we encourage them. We have these celebration of yoga in a very aggressive way in this company, which talks about physical health, mental. Yoga is one thing which supports both the needs, physical and mental health. Meditation, yoga. So we do these camps very often so that people pick up these habits and put it into their lifestyle.
Yeah, it's great. It's funny talking about the physical health piece and the importance of sport and the size of India. Both of those things kind of came together when I was actually just looking at the Google searches globally, the top 10 Google searches. India actually was in 3 of those for cricket. I couldn't believe it. You guys love cricket, don't you?
cricket is like a passion for us because of the IPL over the period of time. Because that actually happened, John, because of 1983 winning the World Cup in England, defeating the West Indies. Okay. So cricket in India took a new shape. The new destiny of India was defined that day because I've been a cricketer myself. I'm passionate about the game myself. I've played for my state. I've played for university. So that's been my passion. So in India, you can rally around people around cricket. So people get together. They watch the sport. They play the sport. So sport is a very important glue for Indians, be it soccer, be it cricket, be it any other sport. But it's a very important requirement of an Indian's life.
Absolutely. I think it's so important that organizations support people to be involved in an activity in sport and the like. And also take control of the part they play in the mental health piece. I know we're coming to the end of the interview, and thank you so much for your time. But before we go, I'd just love to talk about diversity a little bit, and you know, women in the workplace, and how important it has been to try and make the workplace more attractive for women.
This journey for us, John, started in 2015 when we took over the leadership of this company, because we, as an organization, realized that it was a male bastion. So we hardly had any women. Then we consciously said that we need more and more women into the ecosystem. And in a very structured manner, we started attracting more and more women talent across the organization. And currently, we are close to 10%, which is nothing great, but then we started from less than 1%. So therefore, this journey has been very challenging for us, because we needed to sensitize the men to accept the women as equals and accept them in your teams. That sensitization process is still on, John. We have this gender sensitization workshops every 2 months. And we have to align the men to think that a woman can do a job as critical or as physical as a man can do. And then nowadays we have women who are willing to go to the underground mines. They are not afraid. It's the men who are afraid. Yes, we don't send them alone. We send them in groups, ensuring certain safety norms and standards. But it's all in the mind of the men to embrace this change that women can do a job at par with me. It's very difficult for them to accept that they can do it better than me. So it's a cultural change that we are navigating, and the process is on, but we are happy that now we are able to provide through our policies, our processes, our culture, and various things that we've done, which is targeted towards the women, an organization which provides an emotionally and psychologically safe workplace for the women. That's our mantra. And we have a lot of targeted initiative to ensure that we develop women leaders for tomorrow. So targeted leadership development for our women colleagues from across the company. We have separate mentoring programs.
Before, because I think the last time we spoke, you said, was it a she hero or a
she hero? Shiro. Yeah.
Shiro. Shiro.
Yeah.
So the S,
H in brackets, then E-R-O, the Shiro program, we call it.
And so a lot of mentoring for women to move into leadership roles.
Yes, that's
fantastic.
Even during their, when they come into the organization, it's a new environment. So they have women leaders who are constantly mentoring and coaching them.
So Joy, I could speak to you for another hour. I really could. And let's stay in touch, because I think it's wonderful to have a feed of what's actually happening in India. I will get to India. I really am. I've been told by so many people that it's such a brilliant country with so much diversity and so much to see. So I really will get there. But please continue leading the way as you have as an organization, but I think you personally, you have a real passion for this, and you're doing so many of the things that actually make a company a healthy place to work. So thank you so much for the interview, and thank you, and keep up the good work.
Thank you, John. India is an exciting place, the place for the next 30 years. The world is going to look at India.
And I do promise to everybody listening in India, I will visit India, God willing, as soon as possible. What an interesting place, and what an insightful interview. My thanks to Sujoy. I love the passion that he has for sport, but particularly for cricket. When I mentioned cricket, you could just see his eyes light up. Sport is so, so important on so many levels, physically, mentally, and socially. It's something that I think all organizations should really focus on. As always, if you have any ideas on what topics you'd like us to feature on our next podcast, do get in touch. You can follow and connect with me on LinkedIn. I'd love to hear from you. Until next time, work healthy.